The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. Another beautiful day at Edstone, a day, well, pretty enough. We ought to broadcast outside at some point. Could we do that, gents? Could we? We've got wireless down by the campsite, huh? We have to get Richard on that, I guess. If you can't visit Edstone, we should bring Edstone to you. I'll start with a few emails from you listeners. It says, I'm so glad that we have a wonderful lifeline to the truth. It says, I'm a Canadian. We are all also on lockdown in Ontario. Also, our prime minister is spending money like the well will never run dry. It says, the people of Canada are the same as Britain and the United States. The people think this is a staycation on the government's bill. I'm afraid we will all pay the price for their foolishness. That comes from Canada. This one here says, I watch daily. I'm amazed at the almost complete idiocracy and the alternative reality that the liberal media creates and lives in, drawing uninformed, unsuspecting, vulnerable people into their fictional stories fabricated by the mind of Satan. It says, so wonderful to see the truth of God relating to current events. I will be glad when people seek the truth and receive nothing but the truth. Thanks again for the excellent reporting. This one here comes from someone from Zimbabwe who's now living in the UK. It says, I look forward to the program every day. When you and Mark Levin mentioned America and Britain going the way of Zimbabwe, my heart skipped a bit. When you said after the trillion, what's next? When you said that, I recalled vividly how we all became poor trillionaires and how we slipped into a failed state in less than 5 years. Less than 5 years after we had been the breadbasket of South Africa, of Southern Africa, the breadbasket. And all that collapsed in just a few short years. He says, God help us, and may his kingdom come. Another one here, a listener from Zimbabwe, who's now living in the United States. And he writes, yesterday's program hit close to home. I still remember the period of 2008 and 2007 and 8 in Zimbabwe when hyperinflation hit like a locomotive. To witness everything disappear from the supermarket shelves, to hear my parents recount how they had to run to the store as soon as they got paid because money was losing value by the hour, in some cases by the half hour. I thought I had left those days back in 2008, but here I am with a front row seat for the second time in my life. We are about to witness what happens when a government goes mad with the printing press. It's not a pretty sight. Finally, he writes, Zimbabwe is a small nation, perhaps only 5% of the USA population. The impact of hyperinflation was mitigated because of a small populace. When this hyperinflation strikes the USA, it's not hard to imagine how much more of an impact it will have. He says, these are truly abnormal times. Yes, indeed, we're living in abnormal times. These are not normal days. We're living in the last days. In this first article that I want to go through, it certainly indicates that as well. In fact, as I read it, I want for you to try to guess what publication this comes from. So don't put it up on the screen. We'll play it later. We'll put it up later. We'll put it up halfway through. But listen to this content. And see if you can hazard a guess at where it comes from. It says here, the world has never faced a hunger emergency like this. So say the experts. It could double the number of people facing acute hunger to 265 million by the end of this year. And then it rattles off a number of troubling examples from all over the world. In the largest slum in Kenya's capital, people desperate to eat set off a stampede during a recent giveaway of flour and cooking oil, leaving scores injured and two people dead. In India, thousands of workers are lining up twice a day for bread and fried vegetables to keep hunger at bay. That's in India, population 1.4 billion. It says, and across Colombia, poor households are hanging red clothing and flags from their windows and balconies as a sign that they are hungry. It says, here's the key paragraph, the coronavirus pandemic has brought hunger to millions of people around the world. It's the virus. Or is it the virus? Is it the virus or is it the reaction to the virus that's bringing hunger to tens of millions of people around the world? Well, it says in the next sentence, national lockdowns and social distancing measures are drying up work and incomes and are likely to disrupt agricultural production and supply routes, leaving millions to worry how they will get enough to eat. So because of the lockdown, and that's there, it's embedded in the story. Of course, the person writing this is probably convinced in his mind that it's the virus. The virus is the cause. The sickness. The flu-like sickness. In fact, everything listed in that sentence I just gave you, national lockdowns, social distancing measures, that's drying up work. It's drying up incomes. It's disrupting agricultural production. It's disrupting supply routes, especially in second and third world nations, leaving millions to worry how they will get enough to eat. It says already 135 million people had been facing acute food shortages. But now with the pandemic, 130 million more could go hungry in 2020. So this is this year. This year it could double. Says Arif Hussein, chief economist at the World Food Program, a UN agency. Altogether, an estimated 265 million people could be pushed to the brink of starvation by year's end. Did you get that? 265 million pushed to the brink of starvation by the year's end. It says, we've never seen anything like this before, Mr. Hussein said. It wasn't a pretty picture to begin with, but this makes it truly unprecedented and uncharted territory. The world has experienced, now listen to this, listen to this. The world has experienced severe hunger crises before, but those were regional and caused by one factor or another, extreme weather, economic downturns, wars, or political instability. This hunger crisis, now again, notice all the links. This hunger crisis, experts say, is global and caused by a multitude of factors linked to the coronavirus pandemic and the ensuing interruption of the economic order. And then there's a colon. Here are the links. The sudden loss in income for countless millions who were already living hand to mouth. The collapse in oil prices. Widespread shortages of hard currency from tourism drying up. Overseas workers not having earnings to send home. And on it goes. All of these factors that were just listed off directly linked, not to the sickness, I guess you could say indirectly, but directly linked to the pandemonium, directly linked to the panic, directly linked to the lockdown. And what newspaper does this article spring from? Well, that's in today's New York Times. That's on the front page above the fold. That's in your New York Times, the newspaper of record. It says already from Honduras to South Africa to India, protests and looting have broken out amidst frustrations from lockdowns and worries about hunger. With classes shut down, over 368 million children have lost the nutritious meals and snacks they normally receive in school. There's no shortage of food globally or mass starvation from the pandemic yet, but logistical problems in planting, harvesting, and transporting food will leave poor countries exposed in the coming months, especially those reliant on imports. It lists Venezuela, the pandemic there, how it could devastate millions already living in the world's largest economic collapse outside wartime. It's bad enough. Pre-lockdown. And now look, it says uncertainty over food is also building in India, where daily wage workers with little or no social safety net face a future where hunger is a more immediate threat than the virus. So many of these nations, you see, they're more concerned about the food or lack thereof than they are about the virus. It says, this is India, as wages have dried up, 500,000 people are estimated to have left cities to walk home, setting off the nation's largest mass migration since independence. So we're talking about unprecedented times, not because of the sickness itself, because of the pandemonium, because of the lockdowns. It says the Delhi government has set up soup kitchens, yet workers like Nihal Singh go hungry as the things at these centers have increased in recent days, the throngs rather. It says, instead of coronavirus, the hunger will kill us, said Mr. Singh, who was hoping to eat his first meal in a day. It says migrants waiting in food lines have fought each other over a plate of rice and lentils. Mr. Singh said he was ashamed to beg for food, but had no other option. The lockdown, he said, has trampled on our dignity. The lockdown, he says, it's trampled on our dignity. The curfews and restrictions on movement are already devastating the meager incomes of displaced people in Uganda and Ethiopia, the delivery of seeds and farming tools in South Sudan, and the distribution of food aid in the Central African Republic. Containment measures in Niger, which hosts almost 60,000 refugees fleeing conflict in Mali, have led to surges in pricing of food, according to the International Rescue Committee. So there you go. But the good news is that if this can save just one person from coronavirus, if this can save one person from dying of COVID-19, it's worth it, right? It's worth it. Well, that's what the experts have said. That's the Andrew Cuomo model. Total deaths from COVID-19 in India, 681 people. This is a nation with 1.4 billion people. Colombia was mentioned in this piece, 206 deaths. That's a nation of 50 million people. 206 deaths. Venezuela has had a whopping 10 people die because of COVID-19. 10 people. Ethiopia, 3. And then Uganda, they're still waiting on their first casualty. But they're stampeding people to death for food in some of these places because of the pandemonium. Just think about this for a moment. It's the Western nations being hit hardest by this virus. The nations with tens of millions of people with chronic diseases like heart disease, like cancer, lung disease of some kind of respiratory illness, diabetes, of course, high-risk obesity. And so naturally, the highest number of casualties, it comes out of Italy, out of France, out of Belgium, out of Britain, out of the United States. This is where you have the most underlying conditions, making people susceptible, most susceptible to dying from this death or this disease. And yet here you have all of these other second and third world countries. Well, we're just going along. This is what we're supposed to do, right? We're just like that advisor said to President Trump a few weeks back. We're just supposed to do this. So they locked it down in India and Colombia and Venezuela. They're hardly even dying there because of this disease. The disease is hardly even, it's 1.4 billion people in India. The cure, as we're seeing over and again, is far worse than the disease. Now, this is what's astounding to me. This is in the New York Times today. The same paper that just told you about the devastating impact that the pandemonium is having on the world. The same paper says that with no vaccine or cure, the president, governors, mayors, and county executives will have to decide how many deaths would be acceptable to restore a shattered economy. The headline is, "The cold calculations America's leaders will have to make before reopening." Basically, if you're going to reopen, then you have to make a cold calculation. How many people are going to die as a result of you opening your doors, as a result of you opening up for business? This is in the same newspaper. You know, it's being a Christian, knowing what the Bible says about the human heart and about trusting in man. We come under a curse if we put our faith, our trust in man. And so many of you that are listening to this program, you know that we don't even get involved in the politics of this world. We don't vote for this candidate or that candidate as if that candidate's going to be able to fix these problems. Our citizenship is in heaven. It's in God's coming kingdom. But even still, knowing what we know about the heart of man, knowing what we know about the deception coming from the devil, the fact that he's cast down, still the level of incompetence and ignorance among some very educated leaders the world over, all around the world. It's astounding. It's astounding to just see how utterly incapable man is of solving the problems that we've brought on ourselves. And of course, this very condition is in itself prophesied. Isaiah 3 and verse 1 says, "For behold, the Eternal of hosts, does take away from Jerusalem and from Judah the stay and the staff, the whole stay of bread and the whole stay of water." You see, some of those things, the stampeding and the rush to the food lines, it's coming to our nations as well. We're seeing it already. But it's coming in full force. Your Bible says so. Total disaster. That's what this prophecy is about. Where most of the food and water, it just disappears. Verse 2, here's why. The mighty man, God takes this away too. The mighty man, the man of war, the judge, the prophet, the prudent, the ancient, the captain of 50, the honorable man, the counselor, the cunning artificer, the eloquent orator, all the strong, mighty leaders of yesteryear, they're gone. They're gone yesterday in that class on Winston Churchill, walking with destiny. It was inspiring to just see the modern historian I know would say, oh, Churchill wasn't religious at all. In fact, he was agnostic. He didn't think God had his hand in anything as far as human affairs is concerned. And while Churchill certainly wasn't religious, he definitely believed in God's interference on the affairs of mankind. In fact, he told the U.S. Congress in 1941 that you'd have to be a blind soul not to know that there's some purpose being worked out here below. There were numerous times in his life where he was miraculously saved from death. His bodyguard even at one point expressed frustration for just how many risks that Churchill took, and Churchill said, look, don't worry about me. I've got an important job to do. In other words, I'm being looked after. He knew it. He knew it. He said the night he became prime minister, felt like my whole life had prepared me for this point. I was walking with destiny. How many leaders do we have like this today? What we see on display every day is this prophecy here in Isaiah 3. Leaders who instead are paralyzed with fear. I think that's the word the New York Post used, or terrified, it said, about Boris Johnson. He's terrified to lift the lockdown. He got the virus himself, so he has, in some ways, I guess he has good reason to be fearful. But where is the wisdom? Where is the big picture? It's right there on the front page of the New York Times if they'd care to look at it. The thing is, the author of that piece and the others that work at that paper, they're all convinced. As far as direct causes are concerned, they're all convinced it's the virus. It's the virus. We're doing what we have to do. It's just because we're supposed to do it. The Washington Post, regarding some of these states that are working to reopen their doors, it had the headline yesterday, "States rushing to reopen is a deadly error." Now, they've since softened that headline some. But initially it was, "It's a deadly error. You open your doors, Georgia. If you open your doors, Oklahoma, you're going to be guilty of killing innocent Americans." Well, they've softened the title somewhat. States rushing to reopen. See, they're rushing. The only rushing that happened was the effort to close it all down. That happened within a matter of hours, it seemed. WHO, March 11. National emergency, March 13. March 15th, 16, Neil Ferguson's big model. And within hours after that, the close down, the shutdowns began. Now, after weeks of this, so says the Washington Post, these states, Georgia, they're rushing to reopen. It says, closing America was hard. Science suggests reopening amid coronavirus will be even harder. Science? Wasn't it science that lowered down the lockdown gates to begin with? I should say junk science. Perverted science. The models. The model said lock it down. And we certainly did that. It's perverted science that got us in the midst of all this wreckage in the first place. And now here comes the New York Times. Here comes the Washington Post saying, you know what? Science says that if you reopen, you're going to kill people. Listen to what Tucker Carlson said in one of his segments last night, clip 10.
We're currently living through the largest and most expensive experiment ever conducted in human history. We have spent trillions of dollars and crushed millions of people purely on the guess that a nationwide lockdown would save us from the coronavirus. Has it worked? Was the guess correct? Let's look at the data. That's where we should always begin. It's what our leaders should be consulting daily. Here it is. As of tonight, 8 U.S. states have not issued statewide shelter-in-place orders for their citizens. Those states are Arkansas, Iowa, Nebraska, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Utah, and Wyoming. The question is, have these states suffered for not locking down? And the answer is no, they haven't, at least not yet. Currently, all 8 states are below the national average in coronavirus cases and deaths per capita. That's not to say they've been immune to the virus. They haven't been. But they definitely have not been hit harder than other states.
That's Tucker Carlson last night. And that's in the U.S. There's other examples like Sweden and Brazil internationally. But you can't even bring them into the discussion. The science has already decided it not only needs to be locked down, it needs to stay that way indefinitely. Some have said 12 to 18 months. A second wave is coming. Lock it all down. Never mind the stampedes worldwide for food. Purely, he said, purely on a guess. We've spent trillions of dollars and crushed millions of people purely on a guess that a lockdown would save us from the virus. Because where is the evidence that it's even working? We're seeing evidence already of its damaging impact on other sectors of society. But where is the evidence that the lockdown's even helping us stamp out the virus? This was Britt Hume yesterday on Fox News as well, clip 2.
I think it's time to consider the possibility, Shannon, that this lockdown, as opposed to the more moderate mitigation efforts, that this lockdown is a colossal public policy calamity, that the damage to the economy, to businesses, I see, you know, businesses are closing, many may not reopen, those jobs will be lost, those businesses will be lost, those incomes will be lost, plus the effect on children who don't have their normal life, they don't have school, they can't play with their friends, even outdoors, all these things are accumulating. They're not going to get better, Shannon. They're going to get worse with time. And as I say, many of them, we may not recover from many of these losses for a very long time, if ever.
He went on to say that the evidence doesn't even show that it's made any real difference. Colossal public policy calamity. Lyman Stone at Public Discourse. He wrote, centralized quarantine orders, well, his title is lockdowns don't work. Then he says, centralized quarantine orders where individuals who test positive or individuals who have had contact with COVID-infected people are forced to be quarantined for 7, 14, or 21 days in hotels or special purpose spaces are an extremely effective way to fight the disease. In fact, this is how Moses in Leviticus commands the Israelites to combat infectious disease. And it's the strategy used to keep COVID at bay here in Hong Kong, where I live. So here he's talking about quarantining those who are sick. And he goes on to explain, centralized quarantines dramatically restrict the liberties of a small share of the population in order to afford some degree of normalcy to the vast majority. It's common sense, right? That's because it springs from the Bible. The lockdown strategy is one size fits all. If we're doing it in Queens, then you've got to do it in Wyoming. Dennis Prager, by the way, had a pretty good headline the other day saying, what if it was the opposite? What if instead of half of the total U.S. deaths happening right in the New York, northern New Jersey area, what if it was happening in Wyoming? Do you think New York City would shut down the entire city if they were hardly affected? And there were all these people dying in Wyoming? Do you think New Yorkers would go for that if the tables were turned? And yet this is what Governor Cuomo and others are expecting. Those in the media, by the way, they generally associate around those metropolises, New York City, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles. And they look at what Georgia is now considering, or Oklahoma, and they're appalled. It says here, centralized quarantines dramatically restrict. Well, I read that. He's referring to Israel and how it works. It's worked in Hong Kong. At this point, listen to this. The question I usually get is, what's your evidence that lockdowns don't work? He says, it's a strange question. Why should I have to prove that lockdowns don't work? The burden of proof is to show that they do work. Where's the proof showing they actually work? Says, if you're going to essentially cancel the civil liberties of the entire population for a few weeks, you should probably have evidence that the strategy will work. And there, lockdown advocates fail miserably because they simply don't have evidence. There's no evidence. And he goes on to point out how that even in as bad as 1918 was with the Spanish flu, it was nothing like what we see today. A few pockets of the nation, in the U.S., I mean. St. Louis, I think he put forward as an example. But outside of that, it wasn't a national lockdown. You didn't have 42 states locking down. So we're basically just guessing, like Tucker Carlson said. We're making it up as we go because it's never happened. We've never dealt with the virus this way. It's unprecedented. So here are the experts. Science get us into the mess. And now the Washington Post, they're waving science to Georgia, to Wyoming, to South Dakota, to Oklahoma. Science says don't do it. Science says keep it closed. Washington Post says by the end of the week, residents in Georgia will be able to get their hair permed and nails done by Monday. They'll be cleared for action flicks at the Cineplex and burgers at their favorite greasy spoon, and it will almost certainly lead to more novel coronavirus infections and deaths. They're opening their doors in Georgia, and they're going to kill people. That's what the New York Times, that's what the Washington, never mind what other stories bring out what's happening worldwide, even in the New York Times. That's the narrative that the media assails any dissenter with. If you leave your door, if you open your door, you are going to kill someone. I saw some disturbing footage from Arizona. This 71-year-old shop owner, he tried to get, in order to be essential, I think he had a little souvenir shop, so he brought some food in to be able to sell. He brought some feed to be able to sell for animals. And according to what he was waving in his video, he had approval from the state to be essential. But the two police officers there disagreed, gave him a citation, handcuffed him, took him into the vehicle because he wouldn't give him a identification. He probably should have been more helpful, I suppose. There's no need to resist against a police officer asking for ID. But still, a 71-year-old. Who wants to keep his livelihood going? Who wants to keep his business open? As it was, he told the police officers, I only get one or two people in here a day because everyone's terrified. He needs to be arrested. It wasn't that long ago, remember, when these thugs were burning down Baltimore and you had the mayor saying, give him space. Give him space. Just let him do their thing. Let it run its course. Same thing in St. Louis. Just clear out, officers. Let them burn down the city. And then you have incidents like this. And people probably that not that long ago would have been law enforcement's biggest supporters. And now they're being carted off from a park, a playground, in handcuffs. because they're out there playing with their children, because they're out in the sun getting some vitamin D. How much longer is this going to go on? Is there hope in the governments of men? Is there hope for really rallying the people of the United States together or Great Britain or wherever? This is building. It's building to an explosion. Now, with respect to the lockdown, there's a few positive signs, as I say, with Georgia or Oklahoma, but they're coming under attack. This is Oklahoma. This affects, of course, we have quite a few listeners in our headquarters area in central Oklahoma. Here's the Oklahoma governor yesterday telling, I think it was on Fox, what he intends to do with his state. Clip one.
We rolled out a three-phased reopening plan, a very measured reopening plan, because the intent of my 15 executive orders was to flatten the curve and to build capacity in our hospitals. And you're seeing that. We peaked actually on March 30th with 560 people in hospitals across our state. And that is trend has gone down. And today we have 298 people across the state in the hospitals with COVID-related symptoms. So we feel good right now. We're going to be data-driven. And we're going to do a measured phase 1, 2, and 3 reopening starting this Friday. And then again, May 1st with some other things. And we'll move to phase 2 as long as the data and the trends continue to be flattened.
That's Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt last night talking about the three phases for Oklahoma's reopening. He went on to say that in Oklahoma right now, they have 15 times the hospital beds that they need. 15 times. They peaked on March 30th. That's more than 3 weeks ago. The onslaught never happened. Certainly not for Oklahoma. And yet still, they're going to be singled out. You watch. It's already happening. They're going to be singled out. You're the problem, Georgia. You're the problem, Oklahoma. Step back and look at what's happened to this world. In just a matter of weeks, what's happening in India and Uganda and Venezuela and Colombia. And then, as I said on yesterday's show, the way that we're fixing the problem, just printing money, trillions and trillions of dollars, the most expensive, and we could add to that, the most deadly scientific or medical experiment in the history of human civilization. That's what it amounts to. And where is the evidence that the lockdown is even effective? And more evidence comes in, too, that the peak just, well, you just heard the governor there. The peak was weeks ago. And it was more widespread than we realized. Which means it's not as fatal. It's not as lethal. Listen to this question. This was at one of the briefings a couple of days ago. This is John Roberts, the reporter, and he's asking this question of Dr. Birx. Here he is, clip 12.
Dr. Birx, University of Southern California and the LA County Public Health put out a report today that suggests that the penetrance of the virus is as much as almost 40 times what it was believed to be, that as many as 442,000 people in LA County may have been infected, which suggests two things. It suggests that you have a lot more people out there who could be spreading the virus, but it also suggests that the case fatality rate is more in line with the 2017-2018 flu than what we've seen in some other areas of the world. But I'm wondering if you've seen that, what your thoughts were.
It suggests two things. The fact that it is contagious and it has spread out there, and that the fatality rate is similar to the flu of 2017 and 18. Now, Dr. Birx, she gave a pretty long answer where she just didn't answer the second part. The fatality rate. Here's a montage of the long answer, clip 13.
So we're looking at all those studies very carefully, and I think You will remember over the last 3 weeks, I've been talking about the level of asymptomatic spread and my concern about asymptomatic spread. When people are not sick and shedding virus, you have to have a very different approach, a variant. And if you remember, we talked about younger age groups may have more asymptomatic disease, and your asymptomatic disease may decrease with your older age groups, and that your symptomatic disease might increase with age groups. What we don't want to do, and I'm just going to do another 30 seconds on testing, and we will emphasize to the American people again, this is a highly contagious virus. And we don't know by looking at someone whether they have pre-existing conditions or not. And so all of us, as far as protecting others, must continue to do all of the recommendations to ensure that when we are in an asymptomatic state, we're not passing the virus to others.
So that's her basically not answering the second part of the question. She focuses on the testing. She focuses on it's highly contagious. She says that we need to comply with the social distancing. But what about? What about the fact that these figures put out from the most recent study, that's John Roberts saying it's happened right in Southern California, that would suggest that the fatality rate is similar to the flu? What about that? No real response there. The closest that she gets to answering that second suggestion from Roberts is right at the end of that little montage. Let me just play the last part of what she says. Listen to what she says here about how that if you don't know, you're asymptomatic, you don't know that you have it, but you don't know who else has pre-existing conditions. This is clip 14.
We don't know by looking at someone whether they have pre-existing conditions or not. And so all of us, as far as protecting others, must continue to do all of the recommendations to ensure that when we are in an asymptomatic state, we're not passing the virus to others.
If you hear what she's saying there, the danger is not the virus itself. The ones who are at danger or the ones who are most vulnerable, it's the pre-existing conditions. And the reasoning is, if you don't know that you have it, if you have the mild case, if you have the sniffle, if you have a mild case of the flu, and then you spread it, not that we would recommend doing that. If you have it, you quarantine yourself, like we read earlier. But here is an entire society shut down because of individuals that have pre-existing conditions. Not that they deserve to die by any means. But it's all about those with pre-existing conditions, which is what we've been focusing on over the past week. She alludes there to, now they'd never talk about it in terms of root causes or cause and effect, but that's the root cause of this crisis, of what we're seeing unfold all over the world. It's the pre-existing conditions that we have primarily in the more prosperous Western nations, the United States, France, Italy, Belgium, and so on. Really, what she says there is it's a nice way of saying that we're shutting down the world in order to save those who are already sick and infirmed. We're shutting down the world to try to keep our distance from those with underlying health conditions. And meanwhile, in doing that, you have millions and millions of, I would imagine, relatively healthy people or healthier people who are getting sicker because of these draconian measures, or in some cases, who are stampeding one another in order to get to the front of the line for food handouts. But if all of this, we've been told, if all of this will just save one person, this is the only death that counts. It's the COVID-19 death. None of the others matter. And think about, again, going back to the reasoning of Dr. Birx, where does this end? And does it get better or does it get worse? Just going forward, thinking about the chronic diseases that we struggle with in our prosperous nations. This was from the CrossFit website. My wife sent this to me the other day. It says here, each year, 5 to 15% of the world's population is infected with the flu. in the majority of patients, the flu resolves without significant medical treatment, but in those with underlying conditions, the flu can be a severe, even fatal disease. It's just like with what we're seeing with COVID-19. Thus, as rates of diabetes, heart disease, and other conditions continue to increase, as they have for much of the late 20th and 21st centuries, the flu will have an increasingly burdensome effect on patient health and our healthcare system. In other words, because these diseases continually increase, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and so on, it just means more and more people are going to be susceptible to dying a little bit earlier because of the flu. So it's not going to make it any better in years to come. It's going to be worse. Dr. Birx said, we don't know. We don't know by looking at someone whether they have pre-existing conditions or not. So what do? Well, you lock everything down. No one goes out. And that way we don't have any interaction with someone with pre-existing conditions. It's never, ever happened in the history of the world. And now they're guessing, they're hoping that this will stamp it out. And it's not even getting to the root cause of the problem. Yesterday in his press conference in Albany, Andrew Cuomo was asked about the cure and how harmful it is for these New Yorkers that are losing their livelihoods. And he responded with this, clip 3.
How can the cure be worse than the illness if the illness is potential death?
The illness is potential death. It is potential death, but for a very select few, mostly elderly people with underlying health conditions, for the vast majority, it's not that serious at all. The vast majority. We now know this. So this reporter says, well, but there's people really struggling. They're losing their livelihoods. Even suicides are going to be on the rise. Here's how Governor Cuomo responded to that, clip 4.
Economic hardship. Yes, very bad. Not death. Emotional stress from being locked in a house. Very bad. Not death. Domestic violence on the increase. Very bad. Not death. And not death of someone else. See, that's what we have to factor into this equation. Yeah, it's your life. Do whatever you want.
Yeah, if you want to commit suicide, I mean, that's your life. Go ahead with it. But now this is different because someone else could catch it, quote unquote, and then you're guilty. And then you're the cause. Now, as far as I know, I've never heard a commentator out there saying that unemployment's worse than death. But is the unemployment of tens of millions of people, is that worth a very slight risk of death? Or expand it on out to the rest in the world, is the unemployment of tens of millions of people in the United States, and then the starvation of tens of millions of people worldwide, is that worth a very slight risk of death because of a virus? This article at Real Clear Politics talks about, well, just the impact, the negative impact on the livelihoods of people because of a economic downturn, a depression. It talks about, we talked on this yesterday, cancer, the numbers of cases that are not being screened or diagnosed early enough to where they can be treated. It's happening in the UK. It's happening in the United States. But in Governor Cuomo's mind, he said, you know, these COVID-19 victims, they're like his family. And if you just view it as if it's your own family, then you'll come around to his way of thinking. Listen to what he said in the next clip, clip 5.
Yeah, it's your life. Do whatever you want. But you're now responsible for my life. You have a responsibility to me. It's not just about you. You have a responsibility to me, right? We started here saying it's not about me, it's about we. Get your head around the we concept. So it's not all about you.
It's not all about you or me. It's about we. This is the same governor that just a year ago, he was panicking. He said Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, they're going to roll back Roe v. Wade. So we've got to be ahead of the curve here. We've got to enact legislation to make sure that a woman has the right to an abortion at any time in the pregnancy, even up to the actual delivery. The latest of late-term abortions. They passed that through last January, and they were cheering in the state legislature. And he's not there with these women going into Planned Parenthood saying, look, hey, try to wrap your mind around we. You've got a 9-month-old in your belly. Let's not think about me. How about we? How about that other life? Not even considered. Even up to 9 months. Why, it's just a ball of cells. It's not really a life. And yet here he is. Here he is telling New Yorkers, keep it shut down. Everything except Planned Parenthood, of course. That's wide open. That's essential. That's essential. I've used this stat before. It's from the CDC. In New York City alone, 544 abortions out of every 1,000 live births. 63,000 abortions occurred in New York City alone in 2015. 63,000 per year. You can see why Planned Parenthood is not going to be closing anytime soon. That's big business. That's an abortion mill. That's people coming in and out all through the day. And those women aren't thinking about we. You can be sure of that. They're thinking about me, my body, my rights. Here is the governor yesterday talking about the public health risk of lifting this lockdown, clip 7.
Nothing comes before the public health risk of somebody else's life.
Nothing. Nothing. No broad picture vision here. Just focus in on COVID alone. Never mind the other deaths in New York City happening every day. Thousands all through the state and the nation. This takes precedent over everything. He said further, I understand the economic hardship part of it. We all feel that. But listen, we've got to try to save even one life. And what if you're struggling? This was his advice at the end of the clip. He said in clip 9.
By the way, you want to go to work? Go take a job as an essential worker. Do it tomorrow.
The reporter said, so what about those that are struggling, that can't pay their rent? Your office has been pretty slow to get out the unemployment checks, and they're complaining that they need to get back to work so they can pay rent. And his response is, you want to go to work? Go take a job as an essential worker. Simple as that. That's his advice to millions of New Yorkers. Let me just conclude in Deuteronomy 30. As I say, you look at the world today, you think about Jeremiah 17, you think about Jeremiah 10, how that we're not even able to direct our steps. You think about Isaiah 3 on full display every day. And you think a lot, as I've thought over the last few weeks, you think a lot about cause and effect. The root causes of these things. I've got more material. Hopefully I can get into it tomorrow. Just going back to the root cause of sickness. We touched on that last Saturday. But here is Moses saying to the people of Israel, verse 19 of Deuteronomy 30, I call heaven and earth to record this day against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. It says, therefore, choose life, that both you and your seed may live. Choose life. Choose it. Make the choice. Make the decision. Make the decision to obey God and His laws, His physical laws, His spiritual laws, and you will be rewarded, and you will be blessed. Verse 20, it says, that you may love the Lord your God, and that you may obey His voice, and that you may cleave unto Him. For He, God, that is, He is your life. And the length of your days, He's the length of our days, that you may dwell in the land which the Eternal sware unto your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give them. That's what God wants for us. He wants to bless us. And those blessings come upon those who obediently submit to God's authority and God's laws and obey them from the heart. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send feedback to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.